Hey, it's you, man, from KC95 here. Good evening and welcome to Toasted Tavern. Your host, Scott Tobin, and the man called Wags are ready to bring you the night in sports. So pull up a stool, grab a drink, and let's get toasted.
He's back. And granted, we talked about this probably for the last two or three years, but it has actually happened. Albert Pujols is returning to the St. Louis Cardinals. And that is cause for celebration here in St. Louis. Welcome into the Toasted Tavern. I am Wags, joined alongside by Scott Tobin. And, you know, as I said in our earlier message, 2 years ago, we got our man in Nolan Arenado. And guess what, St. Louis? You're welcome. We did it again. We finally convinced Mo to bring Albert Pujols back to St. Louis. Still working on the Sean Manaea thing. That's under the radar. But we did it. We brought him back here to St. Louis and, yeah, I know. We're taking credit for something that we really didn't do. But it's awesome to have Albert back here in the fold. And Scott, first off, how you doing? Gotta check in because we haven't seen each other in about a week. But you must be feeling good because Albert Pujols is back.
I am, man. I'm excited. Like you said, we've been talking about this since he got released by the Angels last year. So, like you said, we've really been talking about it for almost a year now, seriously. And you know, we kept saying, man, if the DH happens next year, look for Albert to come back, watch the three of them go away. And I think somebody on the show predicted it last week that it may happen. I think we need to go back and watch video of last week's episode and see who said, hey, I think Albert may be coming and then Sean Manaea too, or one, or it may get reversed one way or the other. Those two moves were going to happen still. So let's see if that person can go two for two and be perfect on his predictions. You know, we have to get a Swami hat for this show.
We probably will have to if that's the case. And you know, we talked last week about it. I thought that maybe the Manaea thing would be first to kind of solidify that pitching rotation. But you were kind of on the boat of, hey, it doesn't matter which one goes first. If they both happen, it's going to be a good thing for the Cardinals. And yes, we're still waiting on a potential pitching move because, as we'll talk here in a little bit, the starting rotation hasn't looked great yet. It is spring training. It's still early, but there are some question marks when it comes to the starting rotation, when it comes to injuries and just kind of the way these guys have looked early on. But we'll get to that in a second because we have to talk about Albert. He's back. We have talked, like you said, since the Angels released him about what he would bring to this team. And now that the DH is officially here, we can see that it was the perfect fit all along. You needed a guy that could come off the bench or be a DH that would go up against left-handed pitchers and absolutely be able to crush them, which he's done in his career. And, you know, bringing in Corey Dickerson was a big step in, I think, both of our minds of this was the step that needed to happen for Albert to come in, because now you've got that right side covered, you know, the left-handed bat that would be able to hit against right-handed, you know, pitchers. And now you don't have to worry about throwing a DH out there if it was just Albert here. And, you know, Dickerson being brought in was what needed to happen. And because of that, Albert is here. And just talk a little bit about what he's going to bring to this team as far as just the approach at the plate right now. We'll talk about what it means to the team itself, but what can Albert bring to the plate that they've been missing the last couple of years?
Well, I mean, you're talking about possibly the greatest right-handed hitter of all time. I mean, you know, he's a shell of himself. He's not the guy that we remember from 11 years ago. But you go back and you look at what he did last year. I mean, he had 257 at-bats, I believe, and he still hit 17 home runs and had 50 RBIs. I mean, you break that out to a full 600 at-bat season. I mean, he's never going to do that again, but you break that out and you end up with almost 40 home runs and 120 RBIs. So, I mean, he still has a lot of that in him. You know, his splits are bad. Like you said, he's not hitting right-handed pitching very well at all the last 2 years. So, I mean, he is, for the most part, going to be your left-handed DH, or I mean, your right-handed DH against left-handed pitching and that bat off the bench. And like you said, Corey Dickerson was the key, because if you don't make that move, Albert doesn't make sense, because if you're trying to make Albert your everyday DH, it makes no sense, because then you're going back to seeing him struggle like he did in Anaheim. You know, bringing in Dickerson, having that bat off the bench, like you said earlier, is the perfect situation, because now you have Albert and you don't have to push a kid into that role. You don't have to try to put that pressure on a Juan Yepes to step in and try to fill those shoes, something that he's never done before. You know, he's never been a DH and not played a position. You know, he's never faced major league pitching before. That's the thing that everybody forgets. You know, all offseason, everybody was like, oh, man, we've got Yepes. And my argument was, the kid's never seen a major league pitch in his life, and you're going to try to put all that pressure on him. So, I mean, once Corey Dickerson, that move was made, Albert did just kind of fall into place, and this lineup is really dangerous now, and it's going to be fun. But, yeah, I think you're going to see – like I said, you're not going to see the 330, 40 home run, 130 RBI Albert Pujols, but you're going to see a guy who takes, you know, really professional at bats. He's going to draw a lot of walks. He's not going to strike out a lot. And there's going to be some magic moments, because, you know, baseball fans believe in the magic of baseball. And if you don't think that Albert Pujols coming back, putting those birds on the bat on his chest again, walking into that ballpark, you don't think whatever magic is left isn't going to come out at least two or three times this season, you're crazy.
Well, and just look what the event was yesterday when he walked out at spring training. I mean, the standing ovation, he looks better than he has in a few years as far as his stature, and he slimmed down a little bit. So I think he knew that this is the ultimate destination, and he's gotten himself in that shape to be the guy that he was here in St. Louis, not the power hitter, the great person that he was, the best right-handed hitter in history, but just the guy that could get stuff done. And when you pair it with the Cardinal magic, voodoo magic, whatever you want to call it, the fact that he's coming back for one last ride with Yadi and Waino, who actually Wainwright hasn't said it's his last season. So that's something to discuss as the year goes on. But this is Yadi's last year. This will be Albert's last year, as he confirmed yesterday as well. So all of that combined, and the fact that this team maybe could be a World Series contender if this team makes another move or two, it just everything is the perfect storm coming together for this. And you look at it, and he had his struggles in Anaheim. Yes, he did. But he did have a 40 home run season there. He had another 30 home run season there as well. So he had success in LA. And then even as he was struggling the last couple of years, he gets to go to the Dodgers. And that he hits 12 of his 17 home runs with the Dodgers last year. So it's not that it's a resurgence or anything like that, but it does show that he has the ability to do it. And his batting eye is still kind of there. And, you know, strikeouts have increased a little bit as he's gotten a bit older, that's for sure. But he still knows how to hit. And you put him in a ballpark he's familiar with, surrounded by guys he's familiar with and comfortable with, and now he gets to be in a teaching role as well in that. And he was doing that when he was here the first time as well. All of that combined, and it's not going to be the Albert of old, but he's 21 home runs away from 700. I would bet a ton of things that he finds a way to get there. Not just him, but the team and the league finds a way for him to get to 21 home runs this year. And I'm not saying they're going to like juice the ball or anything like that, but they're going to get him into situations where he's going to be able to get out there. And it may be against a right-handed pitcher as well, especially if you get down near the end of the season, he's going to see some more at bats against righties. And, you know, if that means that's what it's going to take to get to 21, I think that's going to be what happens. I think he gets to it.
I hope he does. I hope he does. The team's not going to put him getting to 21 home runs over them getting to the postseason. I mean, if you get into September, you're not just going to throw him out there. Oh, no. If you're in a pennant race and he's struggling against right-handers, you're not going to throw him out there and go, man, we got to stick him out there because he's got to get to 21 home runs. That's not what it's about. I mean, you know, it's about ultimately about winning, you know, and chasing a championship. And Albert said that yesterday. You know, that's his main goal is to get to another world championship, you know, here in St. Louis. Like you said, I hope he gets 21. It's not going to be easy just facing left-handed pitching to get to 21, to get enough at bats. But, you know, if he can be better than he's been the last couple of years against righties, you know, and prove that he can hit them a little bit, then he will get a few chances against righties. And I definitely hope that he gets to there. And, you know, he's also 62 RBIs away from tying Babe Ruth for second all time in RBIs. So that's a record that he's going to chase also. And like we said, he got to 50 RBIs last year in 237 at bats. So, I mean, those are numbers that he can reach. So it's going to be fun. And I don't know if you saw Adam Wainwright's comments yesterday, but Waino basically said, you know, Albert came in here in the best shape he's been in years. He's determined. He's focused. And anybody that thinks that this is just a reunion tour and is underestimating Albert Pujols, you're in trouble, because he's focused and he has a goal and he wants to prove something. And when that happens, pitchers need to watch out. You're going to see a little bit, like we said, he's not the same guy, but we're going to see a little bit of old El Hombre, the machine, every once in a while. There's still some glimpses of that guy left.
A broken clock is still right two times a day, and a older machine will still hit home runs when they are needed. And that's what Albert is going to probably be able to do here. And not just the RBIs, the home runs that he's chasing. He's also trying to get into the top 10 in hits. He's 12 away from 10th all-time, which is Eddie Collins. He's 18 hits away from passing Paul Molitor for 9th. So he'll be in the top 10 by the end of the year as well. He's also 37 hits away from tying Rogers Hornsby for 4th in Cardinals history in hits as well. He's also chasing a guy named Yadier Molina as well for that hit record for the Cardinals. I think those two, there might be some competition there for Albert to try and catch and for Yadi to stay ahead. And that might be another piece that goes into maybe a little bit of a resurgence for Albert Pujols here as well, because you've got that battle and that camaraderie, and you know, you throw Adam Wainwright into that as well. And all three of these guys now have a chance to ride off into the sunset. And it may not be with a World Series championship, but I damn well guarantee you that last game at Busch Stadium in the regular season, if you don't have tickets now, get them, because that is going to be a bittersweet, tear-shedding moment that a lot of us will not be able to replicate in a very long time because of what this team and those guys have meant to St. Louis and the Cardinal organization.
I wouldn't dismiss a world championship. They're going to make a run. They're going to make a deep postseason run. You know, I wouldn't rule out a World Series. And again, I wouldn't rule them out another move or two, you know, either now or at the trade deadline. You know, I think this team, you know, there's a lot of people that have said, oh man, they went for Albert to sell tickets. I don't agree with that. I think they went to go get Albert. I think the fact that they went to go get Albert, to me, it says, hey, we're going to try and win this thing. We realized that we needed another bat, that Yepes wasn't ready, that Gorman's not ready. They went and got these two veteran guys. They didn't have to do that. In the last couple of years, Mo wouldn't have done that. You know, he would have said, okay, well, we're just going to play this out and let the kids go and, you know, we'll see what happens. But that's not what they did. And it gives me a little hope that there's still going to be some moves. And there are some rumors floating around that they're kicking the tires on Sean Manaea again this week. You know, apparently Oakland's asking price is going down a little bit. You know, apparently the first time the Cardinals reached out, Oakland said, yeah, you can have Manaea. We want Libertor. Well, I'm sure Mo just hung up the phone, laughed and hung up the phone. But, you know, that asking price has gone down, you know, and so they're going to kick the tires, and who knows, you know, maybe they are able to pull that off, because, you know, as we'll talk about here in a few minutes, the starting pitching is a little bit scary.
It really is. It is a little bit scary, but, you know, I want to touch a little bit more on this as far as a potential Manaea deal. I mean, bringing Pujols in, yes, that's, sets Yepes down a little bit. The fact that you've got Corey Dickerson in here, who's an outfielder as well, kind of maybe gives, you know, Lars Nootbaar a little bit kick back down to the minors. Does this open up the possibility that those guys are part of a deal for a guy like Manaea, or are they really hoping that Albert comes in here and mentors a Yepes and he is the DH kind of the future? I mean, what's the mindset there? I mean, like you said, the asking price right off the bat may have been Libertor, but what's that asking price looking like now? And does that include a guy like Yepes or a Nootbaar that, because of the Pujols and Dickerson signings, have kind of made them available?
You know, you have to look at that and wonder. I mean, you know, you have to look at Juan Yepes and say, you know, where is his fit with this ball club? You know, not just this year, but, you know, and not just with Albert, but, you know, going forward, because you've got Jordan Walker coming, and you've got Norlin Gorman coming, and you've got Alec Burleson coming, and you've got the Joshua Baez, the kid that you drafted in the first round last year. You've got all these kids coming, plus you still have Goldie and Arenado and Carlson and Bader and O'Neill. You can't have them all playing in your starting lineup, you know, and so if Juan Yepes proves that he really can't play a position, that he's just a DH, I'm not sure that the Cardinals are really looking for just DH guys and their young players. I think they want guys that they can move around and do different things. And in spring training, Yepes' defense didn't look good. I mean, he had a lot of oopses. I mean, I know it was a short sample size, and you can't judge him by that, but he didn't look good in the field or in the bases this spring, which, you know, probably putting a lot of pressure on himself, thinking this was his shot. But yeah, I think he could potentially be somebody that you could look at as being a piece in a trade for, you know, whether it be Mania or some other pitcher. Same thing with Nootbaar. I mean, you know, I don't really know. Everybody loves Nootbaar, and he's done a nice job as your fourth outfielder. But again, where is his future spot? Because, you know, you, like we just said, you've got Nolan Gorman. You know, he's either going to play second base, outfield, or DH. You've got Jordan Walker. He's either going to be DH or the outfield. You've got a kid like we said, Lynn Baez, who was a first-round pick last year, who everybody says is going to be a stud. He plays the outfield. Burleson is coming and has had a good spring. He's an outfielder. So you've got a stockpile of these kids. So you're going to have to move somebody at some point. And Yepes, because he doesn't have a whole lot of defensive versatility, may be the guy that the Cardinals ultimately move.
Well, and we've seen, you know, Nootbaar, in a sense, is a lot like some of these other, I wouldn't say flashes in the pan, because he's still kind of there. He's hitting a little bit this spring, but we've seen it multiple times with a guy that kind of bursts onto the scene. Everybody was a fan favorite. And then all of a sudden the next year, he kind of falters a little bit. So this may be one of those moments where you use that momentum of what he's been doing as a trade ship. I don't know if that's going to be the case. I think the Cardinals do like Nootbaar a lot, and I think you're right. I think it does lend itself more to a guy like Yepes being a part of a deal that actually does happen. But as of right now, nothing has really been said. The trade track has not really been laid out there yet, and it's something that the Cardinals do need to look at, because we mentioned it before. You know, the starting rotation has not looked good in spring training. You know, the ERA is averaging well over 3 runs a game. And yes, it's spring training. You can't take a lot of stock into what you see as far as numbers are concerned, because especially with pitchers, it's about finding their release point, where their pitches are going, getting into a routine, all of that kind of stuff. You can't look directly at the numbers. But we had question marks about the rotation going into spring training, and the numbers aren't helping what we thought was going to happen going into the season. Now, Dakota Hudson, coming off the injury, obviously is still working himself back into it. He's looking okay. Adam Wainwright looking okay, but he's a 40-year-old pitcher. Miles Michaelis started off well, had a rough outing, maybe one of those guys that kind of goes back and forth this year. Not really sure on that. Obviously, Flaherty hasn't pitched. Alex Reyes is out for a while. Johan Oviedo hasn't looked all that good. I mean, it leads itself to you have to make a trade. And I don't think Mo's going to make a trade to make a trade. I don't think he's going to sit there and go, okay, I need a starter right at the beginning of the season to see to really get this thing going. You may not see a trade for a Mania or a Montas or anything like that. And so maybe the quarter pole of the season, just because you really want to see what your starters can do and see if you actually need to make that move. But do you get the sense that it would happen earlier rather than later, or do you see this being more like a mid-season deal?
I think a lot of it's going to depend on what happens the end of this week, because Jack Flaherty's 2 weeks are almost up already. You know, he got shut down for 2 weeks. We're almost to that time frame already. You know, you're going to have an idea, you know, and then within the next week or so of where Jack Flaherty is, and okay, is he going to be able to pick up a ball and start throwing now? Or do we have to say, okay, you need to rest for another 2 weeks and then we'll reevaluate? So I think that is going to play a big part into it, is exactly where Jack Flaherty is at these 2 weeks. Because, you know, if he's able to pick up a ball and throw, you know, next week and start working his way back in, and you can say, okay, he's going to be ready by the middle of May, then you don't have to, then, like you said, you can wait and see. If the middle of next week and your 2 weeks are up and he's still having discomfort, and you say, okay, we need to give this more time, let's give it another 2 weeks, and then we'll see where – then that's when the panic button needs to be hit right then, and you say, okay, we have to make this trade. Because at that point, 2 weeks could lead into a month, could lead into June, could lead into August. You know, I mean, you just don't know with the shoulder, like we talked about last week. And so I think that's going to be the big key, is where Jack Flaherty is when that 2 weeks of sitting and resting and hoping and resetting everything – when we have a better idea of where we're at there, I think that's when you have to really jump in. Because if you wait, I mean, you can say, okay, we can wait till the quarter of the season. But if the Cardinals start the season and you don't have Jack Flaherty, and all of a sudden everybody in baseball realizes, oh man, Jack Flaherty's out till August, and these other guys are struggling, well, guess what? You call Oakland. Yeah, we want Matthew Liberatore and Nolan Gorman and that Baez kid. And, you know, what else can we get from you? And that's what happened to him last year when everybody realized, oh, my God, the Cardinals need a pitcher bad. Well, guess where the asking price went? So, you know, you need to kind of jump on this before it's, oh, my God, we're in desperate situation here. We have to make a move.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the way it's kind of played out, I expect it to happen later than rather than earlier. But you're right on the money. I mean, once it gets out that, you know, you're going to be without your star pitcher for X amount of months, that's when the asking price goes up because they know that you're absolutely desperate, especially if your starters are struggling. So it's almost like you'd rather have the surplus than not. And, you know, this team has always, you know, touted their depth and all the great minor leaguers they have in the system. Well, as you mentioned earlier, you're not going to have anywhere to put everybody, you know, and not everybody's going to get a chance to play. So if you believe that this is your window, you know, Ali Marmol has talked about championships, Molina, Wainwright, Pujols now, everybody's talking championship. At this point, you have to go for it right here and right now. And if that means you give up something and you bring in Manaea and all of a sudden Flaherty picks up a ball next week and he's good to go, all of a sudden you got a two-headed monster there that you go, okay, we're good with this. And then you can slot Wainwright in at three, Hudson at four. You can put Michaelis at five if you want to. You've got other options that you can do, and everybody slots down. It's just like the Blues with, you know, the trade for Nick Leddy. It wasn't a sexy trade, but it allowed a guy like Marco Scandella to slot down into a spot that is a little bit more suited for him, and it kind of solidifies the team. Well, you do that with a trade of getting a Manaea in here, and it slots everybody in the spot where they're supposed to be. You don't want Wainwright being your number one or your number two. He's a great pitcher. He's always been a really good pitcher, but he's not a one or two right now. He is a 40-year-old pitcher that will likely have around a 3.25 ERA, something in that range. He's efficient, don't get me wrong, and I like Adam Wainwright. I really do. I don't want to see him as my number one or number two right now. I want to see him in that 3-4 role where he's kind of seeing the tail end of series, maybe not the aces of the other staff, although he rises to those occasions. Don't get me wrong. He really does. I mean, we saw him against Scherzer last year. I would much rather see him in that 3-4 role rather than a 1-2 role. And if you can get him an eye in here, it slots everybody down. And if Flaherty's good, that's a great 1-2 punch. And that's not even talking about a guy like Liberatore or when Alex Reyes comes back, cross your fingers, putting them into the three role or something like that. There's a lot of options, but I'd rather them be the right options than just throwing guys into a rotation and hoping it sticks.
Well, and you brought up Matthew Liberatore again, and I've watched him pitch a couple of times this spring. He's not there yet.
No,
he's
not yet.
He's 20. You know, everybody keeps forgetting that. He just turned 22. You know, he's still a kid. And he's got really good stuff. You know, he had three or four strikeouts against the Mets, but he also gave up two home runs to Francisco Lindor. You know, he's just not quite there yet. You know, he's only had one really full season of minor league baseball because of COVID and because of everything else that's going on. So he needs to be in the minors. They optioned Oviedo down, so he's not even in consideration anymore. You know, so you're really kind of running out of options. Verhagen's looked okay. You know, he's got pretty good stuff. He's looked pretty good. But, again, you got to look at it and go, okay, where are we going to get all these innings from? Because, you know, there's probably going to be an innings limit on Dakota Hudson just coming back. You know, how many innings is Miles Michaelis going to give you? Miles Michaelis has made 9 starts the last 2 years combined. You know, and he's looked pretty good, but you just don't know. When Jack Flaherty comes back, they're not going to be letting him go 6 or 7 innings when he comes back. You know, he's going to be 5 innings and get him out of there, at least at first, for probably the first month or so, whenever he does come back. You know, Steven Matz is a 6-inning pitcher. You know, that's what, and he's good, but, you know, that's what you're going to get from him. He's going to give you 6 innings, and that's what it's going to be. So you really need another guy that can go out there and eat innings, and I don't know where that's coming from. You know, I mean, they've done a nice job. I will give Bo a lot of credit. I like what he's done with the bullpen. Yep. He's gone out and gotten a lot of veteran guys that have good experience that are under the radar guys, and they've added depth. A couple of them they've signed a minor league contract. So they've got bullpen depth. Not worried about that, but the starting rotation, I just don't know. You can't make your bullpen pitch four innings every night. You just can't do it. No matter how many pitchers you have, 162 game season, it's going to wear them down.
Well, and I'll be perfectly honest. I completely forgot about Steven Matz. And if that tells you anything about the Cardinals offseason, the fact that they're big ticket guy is a guy I didn't even remember was in the starting rotation. And that's not saying anything bad about Steven Matz, because he could be a very, very good pitcher for this team. He fits the profile. He's a ground ball pitcher. It makes a lot of sense for him to be here. But like I said, I completely forgot he was even a part of the rotation. So there's that that you throw in there as well. But you got to make another move. It has to be a splash. And if not to save your bullpen, but also just to make it worthwhile to your offense. I mean, your offense has looked decent. I mean, Paul DeJong has actually hit pretty well here in the spring. He's hitting 357 right now, just three strikeouts and 14 at-bats. Paul Goldschmidt, he started off cold many, many times in his career. I would be shocked if he starts off cold this year. 400, two home runs, three RBIs so far here early in the spring. I don't think he wants to come out cold this year. And you throw in Nolan Arenado hitting decently right now, just a shade under 300. You don't want to put your offense in a bind early on where you have to sit there and say you got to outslug a team, you know, 10-8 all the way through the first two or three weeks. You also have to be incumbent on the offense to not put your pitchers in a position to have to pitch 1-0 games. But right now it looks like the offense has the capabilities, adding in a Pujols and a Dickerson. The fact that, you know, Tyler O'Neill is in the heart of that lineup right now. Dylan Carlson is hitting well as well to start the spring. Your offense is going to be there. You have to have the pitching to make it worthwhile for them to continue to go out there and put up the runs without feeling the pressure to outscore a team every day.
You absolutely do. And this offense, I think, has the potential to do that. Talking about guys that are hot this spring, you didn't mention my boy. You didn't mention Harry. Harrison Bader's tearing the cover off the ball this spring. He looks really, really good. He's hitting the ball to all fields, and he's hitting the ball hard. And if Harrison Bader – people laugh and go, oh, Harrison Bader. Look at the numbers of this team, the win-loss percentage when Harrison Bader's playing. Look at the amount of runs they score when Harrison Bader's in the lineup compared to when he's not. Harrison Bader is a huge cog to this offense. And if he plays like he did the second half, the end of 2021 or 2020, and then the second half of last year when he got health, or basically all of last year once he got back from injury, I mean, you have legitimately, and people laugh when you say this, you legitimately have a 270, 20 homer, 20 stolen base, Gold Glove center fielder. There aren't very many of those in the game. You know, I mean, he's huge. And going back to Paul DeJong real quick, the most exciting thing I've seen about Paul DeJong is he's driving the ball to right field. He's hitting the ball in the opposite field. He's staying back. He's not jumping. He's being patient at the plate. If Paul DeJong is somewhere close to the Paul DeJong of 2019, if you get a guy that hits 30 home runs and drives home 75 or 80 runs, he can hit 230, because you know what? Paul DeJong is going to be hitting seventh or eighth in this lineup. And that just goes to show you how much deeper this lineup was, because remember last year and the year before, we were talking about Paul DeJong having to be your cleanup hitter.
Yeah, that's very true.
And I mean, that's not who he is. He's a guy who's going to hit a lot of home runs, and he's going to strike out a lot. And he's a sixth or seven or eight hitter in a really good lineup. And that's what you're going to find him to be this year.
So what does he have to do to make fans forget about the Cardinals not going out and signing a Trevor Story or making a move and a play on Carlos Correa? I mean, 230, you look at it and you go, 230. But 30 home runs, that's big from the spot that you're talking about in the lineup. The fact that he could probably put in 60, 70 RBIs, that sort of thing. You know, is that the threshold that he's going to have to get to? And okay, let's add this into there. So let's say 230, 70 RBIs, 30 home runs, and he wins a Gold Glove this year. Is that enough for fans to sit there and go, okay, we're okay with the fact that we didn't go out there and sign a Trevor Story or a Carlos Correa? It gets us to the next guy. Is that enough?
You know, there's going to be a good amount of Cardinal fans that are never going to be happy because, you didn't go get one of those other guys. But, yeah, I mean, I think I'd like to see him hit closer to 240. I think he could be a 240 hitter. If he could give you 240 between 25 and 30, between 70 and 80 RBIs, and play, he doesn't have to win the Gold Glove, but if he's in the conversation, Gold Glove caliber shortstop, which he's done multiple times in the past, I think you have to be more than happy with that. And, you know, let's pay attention, too, because Trevor Story is not in Colorado anymore. Yeah. Carlos Correa is not in Houston anymore. Let's see how not playing in those ballparks let's see how that affects their offense. Because if you look at the projections for this year, most of Paul DeYoung's projections are actually above what they're projecting for Trevor Story offensively for this season.
That's going to be a season-long thing to watch for sure. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more about the American League setup and the National League setup here in the next couple of days. So make sure you stick around for our AL preview, which we're going to try and knock out there tomorrow. And we'll preview the National League next Monday as well as we lead up to opening day, which is April 7th. It's Thursday. You'll be there. I'll be there. Who else is going to be there? Let's let us know. Let us know who's going to be at opening day. We can meet up. We can hang out. We can say hi. Make sure you guys do that. I'll be out in the bleachers, hopefully catching an Albert Pujols home run ball. You know, it's possible.
You never know.
Never know.
Not sure where I'm going to be. I'll find out tomorrow because I got to go down to the ballpark tomorrow and pick up stuff and get ready and discuss how early we have to actually be there on Thursday because they're talking about 8:30 or 9. Game doesn't start till 3. Games are opening at either 11:45 or 12. I mean, it's gonna be insane downtown. Brad Thompson was joking today saying he thinks they need to add more seats to Busch Stadium because there's not enough seats for all the people that we're gonna want to get in that ballpark.
I'll be perfectly honest. I bought a opening day ticket Monday morning at about 4 a.m. when I was at work because I got up, I saw the news that Albert had signed. And I'm like, well, fuck, the Cardinals did it. They did it. They suckered me in. They got me to buy an opening day ticket. I mean, I was going to go to games this year. It wasn't that I wasn't going to go to games. But I was like, you know, it's opening day. It's always a mess. You know, it's a lot of fun, but I'd much rather watch it on TV. And then all of a sudden, Albert signs. I'm like, damn it, I have to go. Like, I have to go see Albert on opening day. The fact that, you know, the starting pitcher for Pittsburgh may be a lefty because their top guy is a left-handed pitcher. You might see Albert on in the opening day lineup. He's going to be riding on the truck and all that stuff. And then just to be down there to experience it, the gravitas, and it's the first real true opening day since the pandemic hit. I mean, it's the perfect storm to have a perfect day, except for the weather, which is probably going to suck. But being there with so many Cardinals fans and, you know, maybe getting a little inebriated would be a fine thing. I mean, we're not called the Toasted Tavern for nothing. I mean, it's going to be an absolute blast. And yeah, I think I say I get suckered in, but I'm actually psyched to be able to go to opening day next Thursday.
Man, we talked last year how disappointing it was that Nolan Arenado didn't get to see what a real opening day was like in St. Louis. He's going to see it this year. It's going to be as fun as last year was, and he hit the home run on opening day and all of that in front of a small crowd because of COVID restrictions. I mean, it's going to be absolutely insane, and he's going to get a huge ovation on opening day because he didn't get that full win last year. It's going to be crazy. The ovations that Albert gets, like you said, the ovations that Yadi and Waino get when they come in from the bullpen. It's going to be so much fun, man, plus the Hall of Famers and the Clydesdales and – yeah, it's going to be – I mean, honestly, for the first time in 2.5 years, baseball will really be back in downtown St. Louis next Thursday.
Yeah, and honestly, I would be shocked if people sat down at all during the game on Thursday, mainly just because they're probably going to stand up and cheer the entire time for that reason only. So, yeah, so let us know if you guys are going to be down there for opening day. We'll make some plans to get out there and see some people, hang out and say hello and meet some of you guys that listen in. It'd be a nice thing to do and see, and it'd be great to get back out to something a little bit normal. Speaking of normal, the Blues got back to it last night and had a little bit of a momentous occasion as well. And that's Vladimir Tarasenko collecting .500 in his Blues career and in his NHL career as well. And there was a much deserved, a much needed moment for him last night. 2 goals and an assist for a guy that wanted to be traded in the offseason to get that in St. Louis as a Blue. Absolutely incredible moment for him last night. You could tell the emotions kind of got to him during his post-game presser with Darren Pang. But I, for one, am just thrilled that he was able to get that as a Blue. It helped the Blues to a 4-1 victory over Vancouver, a much needed and much crucial win for the Blues in that moment, because they've been struggling in the month of March. They were not good, and they slipped from second place. They were down in fourth for a little while. They're third right now, a point ahead of Nashville. They do have a game in hand on the Predators, but it's kind of a battle between Minnesota, St. Louis, Nashville, and surprisingly Dallas, who are charging hard at the moment. And it was just a win that needed to be had. The Blues got it, and it's important because they're going on this Western Canadian road trip now to Vancouver, to Edmonton, and to Calgary. Three very, very tough places to play, places that the Blues don't have very much success in as well. So to get that and to have Tarasenko get that moment where he ties, well, not ties, but joins Federico, Hall, Sutter, Unger as the only players to get 500 points in their Blues career. Just a great moment last night, but it's a setup to the Blues needing to go on more of a run.
Well, they have to. I mean, it's not even a need to at this point. It's a they have to if they want to play in the postseason, because, I mean, they've not looked like a playoff team in the month of March. They really haven't. And you're right. It's cool that Vladdy got that in St. Louis. You know, if he would have gotten traded and got what he wanted, you know, he wouldn't have gotten that kind of a ovation. It wouldn't have been that big of a moment in some other city. People have been like, who's this guy and what'd he do? You know, I mean, so yeah, very cool that he got it here. I'm glad he's still here. Big part of this team. And, you know, they just got to figure it out, man. This team is so hard to figure out, dude. You know, and it feels like we do this every year. Yeah. It's like, oh man, they're a Stanley Cup team. Oh man, they suck. Oh man, they're great. Oh man, they suck. Our goalies are horrible. Our goalies are great. Our offense is great. Our offense sucks. You know, I mean, and it's just, it's like the team's bipolar. They don't know their identity. It's like, I don't understand it. I really don't, because I've never seen a team year in, year out that can just go through these stretches where they just don't look like, I mean, they literally don't look like they care some nights when they're out there. You know, and just the fact that we talk about this year after year after year, coach after coach after coach. And I know all teams go through phases, but it seems like the Blues go through the same stretches every year where you're talking about the exact same things over and over and over again. But, you know, this team is super talented. You know, they've just got to figure it out and get going. And some of the guys that played really well early in the season, Jordan Kyrou needs to step up and start playing like the kid that everybody was so excited about during the All-Star break. And, you know, we kind of said this a week or two afterwards. That might have been the worst thing that happened to him.
Yeah.
Was that he went there and got all those accolades and everybody talked about him, because he hasn't been the same player since he came back. You know, doesn't seem like he's worked as hard on the defensive end or on any end, honestly. It's just kind of been lackadaisical and kind of the Jordan Kyrou that, you know, people were kind of down on a year or so or 2 years ago and talked about whether he was really part of the future of this team. You know, so, you know, he needs to step up. You know, some of the veterans need to step up. You know, they play hard, but you know, David Perron's disappeared way too many times this year. He's been good lately. I'm not going to take that away from him, but he, you know, he has gone through long stretches where he's been kind of invisible. Braden Schenn's gone through stretches. I mean, I know he's been injured as well. You know, the guy, and I know he works hard and he's your captain and he plays hard, but it just doesn't seem like we ever talk about Ryan O'Reilly. I mean, the Cup year, that was all we talked about was Ryan O'Reilly and all the things he would do. And it just seems like he's invisible a lot of nights out there.
You know, when it comes to O'Reilly, he was the one that willed that team to win in 2019. You know, he was the only guy that was playing well. He basically took that team upon his back. Him and Pietrangelo really just drugged that team into the playoffs. And then through that entire stretch, it was them and their leadership. And, you know, I look at this team now and they have so much more talent and so much more ability that he doesn't necessarily have to do all of that stuff. And I think that's why it looks like he's disappeared, because he doesn't have to be the guy that drags the team across the finish line. He doesn't have to be the one that puts in the important goal or makes the important play. They've got a lot of opportunities around that. He's not a first line guy. You know, he's the number one center. He's the best center on the team. He wins a faceoff when you need to win a faceoff. He's a hard worker. He gets in there, but he's a third line player. And I think that's where the disconnect is you've got him on the top line. He's a number one center, but he's a third line player. And because of that first line is out there, but it's not out there in a sense. If I don't know if that makes any sense in at all, but you know, they're out there, they're doing their job. It's almost like the first line's out there to sustain the team. And then the other lines come along and they're the ones that put the pressure on and they go out and they score all the goals. Whereas that first line is kind of holding the line and it's not a exciting type of play. It's not sexy or anything like that, but they do what they need to do to keep the game level and they let the other lines do the work around it. And I think that's where a lot of those guys get lost because they're not putting pucks in the net. They're not the ones that are, you know, making highlight reel plays, but they're doing the things that allow the other guys on the team to do those things and get their rest on the bench when they make the line change. I think that's where it gets a little bit lost. They're the hardworking first line that's not a first line.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I guess my point is, and like you said, you know, in 19, O'Reilly was the guy that led that team. He was the guy when they went through stretches. He was the one that was getting the goals to break them out of those slumps. You know, David Perron was doing that. You know, Braden Shen was doing it. Those guys just don't seem to be doing that right now. And that, I guess that's where I go back to they've kind of disappeared because you do have all this other talent. But when they're not doing it, when the Kyrus aren't playing like they did earlier, when you don't have Buchnevich or when Robert Thomas is having a rough stretch, that's when you need those guys to step up and find – be those leaders and will this team to win. And it just doesn't seem like they're able to do that in big stretches this year for whatever reason.
And I think why is because they're going up against top lines. And because they're not a technical top line, they're getting beat in a sense. Not beat for goals, but they're the ones that are having to withstand the rush and the attack of the top line. And because they're an older group and because they aren't top line material per se, they're not able to do what they normally do. They're grinding. They feel like more of a fourth line than a first line. And I think that's part of it. And it's okay because if you go up against the top line and you can kind of like maintain it, it makes sense. It does come down to matchups. And if you need a guy like an O'Reilly or Braden Shen or David Perron to grab a team and pull it up, it's incumbent on Coach Berube to make sure his matchup of that line isn't going up against that top line. And he's done a masterful job in his time here in St. Louis of mixing and matching and putting guys in the right spots to succeed and all that stuff. But it feels like, at least this year, there's been a couple of moments and some instances where the right trigger hasn't been pulled. And that's when this team goes through those stretches of just mediocrity. And then all of a sudden, like you said, they can flip a switch and, you know, play a really good game, go on a bit of a run, get people excited about, oh, this team's back. And then they fall flat again. And, you know, people point at the goaltending, people point at the defense, which the defense has been a mess for ever since Pietrangelo left. And even the last year or so that he was here, it wasn't all that great. And my brother has made an excellent point time in and time out over the last couple of years about what the difference is between this team and the team that won it in 2019. And I haven't gotten the numbers just yet because, you know, that would, I don't know if there's even a measurable way to do this, but if you look at the overall length and reach of the Blues defense in 2019 versus the overall length and reach of the Blues now, I guarantee you there's a significant difference in that gapage. And you're starting to see that with guys that are able to get into the slot and get really good looks in front of the net because you have shorter defenders with shorter arms and sticks aren't able to get where they were previously when you had Jay Bomeister out there, when you had Colton Parayko, when you had Alex Pietrangelo, you had all these taller defensemen with long reach clogging up the middle. Well, all that's gone now, and the only tall guys you have are like Parayko and Mikkola. They don't play together. Parayko's kind of been a little bit off the last couple of years. He just hasn't really found that partner to work with that he had with Jay Bomeister. There's just a lot of that going on where you lose that length and all of a sudden your entire game plan has to change. And I don't know if the Blues have changed that game plan.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions. I mean, I think the thing that bothers me is just a couple of weeks ago when you see guys like Ryan O'Reilly come out and you see David Perron come out talking about this team doesn't know who they are. They need to find their identity. They still don't know who they are. They still don't play hard every night. I mean, he was – when you saw the interview with Ryan O'Reilly and he said some of those things, it seemed pretty casual and like he wasn't that worried. If you actually read it, because I read his comments, I was like, holy crap, this doesn't sound good. This sounds like a guy who feels like this team isn't together and they're not all on the same page. And, you know, that has to be a concern, I think, because, you know, are they really not all on the same page? Are those guys, like you said, that played that more physical style that won the cup, and these younger guys, are they all not really connecting together and being a cohesive unit on the ice, which we've heard people talk about. O'Reilly talked about it that night, that everybody wasn't playing as a team. They were playing for themselves and not for each other. And when you hear stuff like that, that's not what you want to hear this late in the season from a team that everybody's talked about being a Stanley Cup contender, or at least, you know, I mean, that's stuff that the media has talked about this year. Here's a question for you. And I know I'm rambling just a little bit here, but question for you. I know Craig Berube signed his new contract and everything looked really pretty when he signed the contract. They were playing great. If this team, as good as they played with all the talent we talked about, because this forward-wise especially is the most talented Blues team that we've seen since probably the Brett Hull, those days in the late 90s, early 2000s. If this team falls apart and would miss the playoffs or get knocked out in the first round, do you start looking at Craig Berube and going, okay, you know what? We won a cup with him, but the last 3 years now, it's kind of fallen apart in the second half of the season, and he hasn't been able to pull that switch. Yeah, we gave him this contract extension, but is he really the right guy for this team? Do you start looking at that going, maybe we made a mistake giving him that contract extension when we did?
I mean, you have to look at the last 2 years before this and say that it was unprecedented. You had the COVID issue, you had, you know, the bubble, all that stuff. So I almost look at the last, the 2 years previous and just go, you know what? You kind of have to throw that out and it doesn't count. This year has shown that it's been up and down and the right buttons haven't been pressed all the time. I feel like if the Blues completely miss the playoffs, you know, the start of next season is paramount. You have to come out strong. You have to come out hot and you have to come out with an intensity that you haven't seen here since 2019. If they make the playoffs and go out in the first round, I think he gets a little bit longer of a leash. And if they go, you know, to the second round or something like that, I think, you know, you go forward with what you got. But I think he gets to start the next season, definitely, regardless. Well, but if it's missed the playoffs, that leash is very, very short. If they get knocked out in the first round, that leash can go to varying lengths depending on how that first round series goes as well. You know, if you're the second or third seed and you're playing Minnesota and they've got Marc-Andre Fleury and all that stuff there and it's a really tight series, I think maybe he gets that longer leash. But, you know, if you're the first wild card and you have to go through the Pacific and you lose in the first round, then I think you sit there and go, "Ooh, really, maybe we should be rethinking this." But you also have to look at it too and go, this team has been paying coaches that haven't coached here a lot the last couple of years. And you may have to just bite the bullet and really hope that this team can rally next year, regardless of what happens, and really kind of push forward into something a little bit more positive. So, I mean, it kind of depends on how the year finishes up. But if they miss the playoffs, you really do have to start looking at it and go, what do we have to do differently? Because the talent's there. Did we make a mistake spending too much money on defense? Did we not shore up the goaltending like we thought we were supposed to? There are going to be those question marks as well, but it does start with the coach. And it would be bad to sit there and say that Craig Berube could be gone. But it would be something you'd have to look at if they don't make the playoffs. So we'll have to kind of see how it plays out. But the one thing that could help is the fact that Colorado may not have their best player. Nathan MacKinnon potentially fractured his hand in a fight with Matt Dumba on Sunday. He's going to be out for an indefinite amount of time. They're still missing Gabe Landeskog, Sam Girard, and Ryan Murray, although Girard has been cleared to skate. The one thing that makes me sit there and pause and go, yeah, Colorado's going to be fine. MacKinnon's missed a bunch of games this year, and in that time frame, they've only lost two of those games. So this is still a really good team. But if you don't have MacKinnon for the majority of your playoff run, I think that will take a toll on this team. They're still really, really good. But Colorado could be a team that you might be able to take out early. Maybe not the Blues, but maybe that first-round opponent can knock them out. And that would make the Blues run a little bit easier as well as everybody else's, because Colorado is the cream of the crop in the West. And if you can knock them out because their top guy is out, that would be huge.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not that suddenly makes it a cakewalk, because it's going to be a tough run through these playoffs. This isn't going to be easy no matter where you go. But yeah, if Colorado could somehow, like you said, if that McKinnon isn't able to play and they get knocked out early, that would definitely make things a little bit easier.
That it sure would. That it sure would. It's going to be a fun stretch down the way here. We got about a month left to go in the season. Lots of playoff implications in every single game that gets played here on out. We got two against Minnesota coming up next weekend here in St. Louis in the next couple of weeks. So those are going to be big games as well as they chase Minnesota for that second seed and home ice advantage in that first round. So that is going to be a big time test, especially going up against Marc-Andre Fleury a couple of different times. We saw what he did against us in Chicago. A sad note in the NHL. Ottawa owner Eugene Melnyk died at 62 after a battle with an illness that was not disclosed. He'd owned the Senators since 2003, so we just want to send our well wishes to those fans in Ottawa, to Melnyk's family, and anybody associated with the Ottawa Senators. We know Brady Tkachuk is up there playing for the Sens as well, so we just want to send our well wishes up there and let them know we're thinking of them. And then on a positive note, the Boston Pride. They won the second straight Isabel Cup this past weekend. They're third overall in the league since that's been running since 2015. They had a third goal, third period to rally back against the number one seed, the Connecticut Whale. Jillian Dempsey got a goal and an assist in that game. She is the league's leading scorer in that time frame as well. So just congratulations to the Boston Pride. And I'll be perfectly honest, I cannot wait. And I really hope that they get this done in the next couple of years, that we see a St. Louis team in the Pro Women's Hockey League as well, because we know what St. Louis hockey is all about. We've seen what they've done as far as the women's game here. We had USA Canada here for two games. The only place that had two games in that She Believes Cup that was going around before the Olympics. So it just shows you how much women's hockey is big here in St. Louis. And I really, really hope that in the next couple of years, they find a way with the Blues to put together a team and get it into that league, and maybe we see a couple more championships coming St. Louis's way.
That would be very cool. Yeah. Women's hockey is entertaining, and that would be definitely fun to see a team here in St. Louis for sure.
And we've got a lot of local St. Louisan connections as well, especially on the Olympic team. So yeah, that'd be something I'm looking forward to. And you know, if you're out there listening and you need a, you know, a play-by-play person or somebody to be a part of the broadcasting department for a potential St. Louis women's professional team, you got a couple guys right here that will find their way to make it happen. So make sure you do that. All right. One final thing before we get out of here. It's not really a final thing because we're going to talk a little bit about it, but the Final Four is coming up this weekend. And after a Cinderella run by St. Peter's and a lot of big time upsets, a lot of number ones going down early, a lot of the top seeds going down early, we finally got down to the Final Four teams. And it is a bunch of teams that are there pretty much every single year. You've got Kansas and Villanova in the first matchup. The Jayhawks, the lone number one seed left in the tournament, and kind of an under-the-radar team right now. They've kind of gone about their business, won big in a lot of their games, and yet no one seems to be talking about them. Going up against a Villanova team that lost their top player in Justin Moore in the Elite Eight to a torn Achilles. That one... you know, I'm almost leaning towards, I think it's going to be a Kansas victory. I think they can take advantage of the, you know, Villanova missing out on Justin Moore. But this is a Nova team that has not won their championships with just one player. They are a team unit, and they're going to have guys that are going to rally around Justin Moore and his injury and do their best to kind of push forward. But, you know, looking at it, I know Remy Martin and Agbaji are going to be huge parts of this Kansas offense. And I think it's just going to be a little too much for Villanova to handle. I think Kansas ends up getting to the national championship game.
Yeah, I mean, Kansas is going to be tough. I do think, though, if there's one team that can handle losing a superstar like that, it is Villanova. Yeah. In my estimation, Jay Wright's the best coach in college basketball right now. Just what he's done with Villanova the last 7-8 years. You know, this is the third time they've made it to the Final Four, won two championships. I think it's going to be a really good game. Like you said, Nova plays a team game. It's really not a one-on-one. They really spread the ball around, get everybody involved. And I need them to win because I have them losing in the championship games. And I hate freaking Kansas. Sorry, any Jayhawks fans out there. But, yeah, Nova needs to take out Kansas. How do we get the Final Four and we have Duke and freaking Kansas? The two teams that I hate the most in the world played in this damn Final Four, really, with all the upsets we had?
Hey, you know what? Duke's not going to get there. Okay. The magical run for Coach K is going to end in the Final Four late Saturday night, because not only is Duke going to lose, but they're going to lose to their bitter rival in my team, the North Carolina Tar Heels. Hubert Davis in his first season is going to make it happen as the 8th seed. Who are we kidding? This is going to be somehow, some way made to be Duke's final stand, and they're going to end up winning this game and going to the national championship. Coach K is going to go out cutting down the nets, all that stuff. We already know what's going to happen. We know Duke is going to win the whole thing. Come on. It has to be the way it goes down. But, I mean, I can dream, right? The Tar Heels have made it. They're an 8th seed. They've really played well as of late. I mean, Duke has played well as of late as well. But in the final game of the season, North Carolina crushed Duke in Duke. So that's fresh in everybody's mind right there. And somehow, some way, and I could not believe this when I was listening to the game on Sunday, that this is the first time that these two teams have ever met in the NCAA tournament. Now, they got close. 1991, they both made the Final Four, but UNC lost to Kansas, and Duke beat UNLV on their way to the title. And ironic if that would be the case, where Kansas and Duke meet in the final again and Duke wins it. But, you know, they'd have to beat North Carolina to get there. But 91 was that time that they almost had a chance, and they would have met in the championship game. This is the semifinals, the first or the second game of the Final Four. And it's everything's set up to be an epic game. You know, it's Coach K's last ride. This is, like I said, Hubert Davis's first time, first season as head coach of UNC. And you could tell the emotion of making it just to the Final Four was enough for Hubert Davis because of the team that he had behind him and the fact that it was his first year. I don't even know what would happen if he wins a national championship. I mean, he may just up and retire and be like, I reached the mountain, Roy Williams, I'm done. I don't think that'd be the case. But, you know, Hubert Davis has really infused North Carolina with a little bit of a different style. Caleb Love, St. Louisan, has been phenomenal in this tournament. Armando Bacot has had a huge game on Sunday, really shut down that St. Peter's offense and kept the defense just kind of guessing all night long. But Coach K and Duke, they've got opportunities. They've got a good team around them. This is going to be – it's either going to be a massive blowout one way or the other, or it's going to be one of the most epic Final Four games you're ever going to see.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really good game, really good game. I'm pulling for Carolina to pull the upset. And so you know what your strategy is now for the tournament, right?
Never pick North Carolina.
Never pick Carolina, and they'll be just fine. But yeah, it's going to be fun. And like you said, Caleb Love's been unbelievable. The St. Louis kid, 30-point game the other night, you know, just really has carried Carolina the last couple of games. So it'll be fun on Saturday.
It really, really will. And like we said, this is going to set up for a very good national championship game on Monday as well. So, you know, we got really good teams in the Final Four, and yes, they may be hated in Duke and Kansas, but if they do end up getting there, you know, you're going to watch on Monday, you know, you're going to get a really good game. It's going to pain you to watch that if that's how it ends up being, but you're still getting good college basketball, and it's the perfect time of the year. You're going to have national championship on Monday. You've got the NHL wrapping up their season in the last couple of weeks here. You've got baseball starting next Thursday. It's opening day. We haven't even talked about the NBA, and I feel like such an idiot for not doing this because we've got a team down there in Memphis that has just been crushing it this year. John Morant has been in and out of the lineup, but they've secured a playoff spot. They have a chance to really make some noise in that Western Conference. And we got to start talking about that a lot more as we get down the stretch here, because you could see a national championship team here in North Carolina. You could see a NBA champion in, you know, Memphis, very, very close. Although the Bulls are also in the mix as well. We got to talk about them a little bit too. And the fact that the Lakers are going to have a losing record this season.
Isn't that a shame? Talking about the Grizzlies real quick. We're working very hard to get Rob Fisher, the pre and post game host for the Memphis Grizzlies, to join us. St. Louis and spent a lot of time on the St. Louis airwaves back in the day, if anybody remembers that. So hopefully we can work that out to get Rob in and talk some NBA basketball as we get closer to the playoffs. And a lot of football stuff still going on too, real quickly. All you Kansas City fans, the Chiefs still trying to nail a number one wide receiver. They're apparently calling all over the league, trying to get a wide receiver, number one wide receiver, to fill Tyreek's hole. And our friends up north, the Bears fans, I know we're short of time here, but I feel sorry for you because there's one franchise. I have no idea what the hell the Bears are doing. They Justin Fields, I don't understand. You got rid his best wide receiver left. You've done nothing to replace him. You got rid of your best defensive player. You've done nothing to replace him. Chicago Bears fans, I'm sorry. Anyway, that's all I got tonight, Wags.
Yes, Chicago. This is the one time we're going to feel sorry for Chicago. It's because we don't have a football team here. We feel sorry for Bears fans. Sorry. It is what it is. So, Justin Fields, good luck up there. We'll see how it plays out. And like I said, lots of other stuff happening in the next couple weeks. Make sure you come back tomorrow night. We'll have our American League preview as well. For Scott, I am Wags. We want to thank you guys for joining us tonight. Make sure you tune in tomorrow as well. And catch us the rest of the week as well. And we'll let you know when and where on our socials. Until then, I'm Wags. For Scott, see you guys later.
Hey, it's you, man, here from Casey. For all your sports news, catch the Toasted Tavern with Scott Tobin and the man called Wags weeknights at 9 p.m. You can follow Toasted Tavern on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Let's get toasted.